And we've even got a couple of our families. And but if you think that you're in pretty good shape and you've perhaps had the vaccine, you might want to ask Tom, maybe even Tom and his wife, perhaps you and your wife, or your wife and your husband, might want to go out for breakfast with them or lunch with them or something like that, but would urge you to be thoughtful for Tom being here and support the meeting as much as you can. I know that he wants to do the very best job that he can here, and I'm thankful for that. 1 John chapter 1, beginning in verse 1, the apostle writes what was from the beginning, what we've heard, what we've seen with our eyes, what we have looked at and touched with our hands concerning the word of life. And the life was manifested, and we have seen and testify and proclaim to you the eternal life which was with the Father and was manifested to us. What we have seen and heard, we proclaim to you also, so that you too may have fellowship with us. And indeed our fellowship is with the Father and with His Son, Jesus Christ. These things we write so that our joy may be made complete. John speaks in behalf of himself and the other apostles and their experience with God's Son who came to earth and became flesh. And I appreciated Ryan mentioning that idea in his prayer for us this evening, that we're thankful that God sent His Son, that He became a man, and not only became a man, but He suffered and died among us and for us. And this really is the central truth of all Scripture. The birth of Jesus was prophesied 700 years before it took place, if we're calculating Isaiah's prophecy somewhat correctly. The purpose of His coming was also foretold in the book of Isaiah, in Isaiah chapter 53. The method of His death, we were given a shadow of it, a glimpse of what it would be like with the brazen serpent. And as that occurred more than 1,300 years before it actually occurred. Find that in the book of Numbers. The psalmist in the 22nd Psalm gave us a picture of Jesus on the cross, probably about 1,000 years prior to Jesus going to Calvary. And even those who doubt the inspiration of the Scriptures have to admit that the Jewish Scriptures existed several hundred years before Jesus died. They cannot deny that those prophecies are there. They might argue about their meaning and call it coincidental that some of those things seem to fit regarding the life of Jesus, but they would say that to talk about God's Son coming and living on this earth, it's only a myth. And I guess in our day we'd have to say that maybe the vast majority of men do not accept that, do not believe it. They would suggest it's a fairy tale, that it was created to make us feel better about our existence and maybe to give us some hope beyond the grave. But they do not believe in its reality. We can't really talk about temptation without taking note of Jesus becoming a man and taking note of His being tempted and how that He dealt with His temptations. And I wish that I was equipped both in intellect and in ability to stir your hearts and your minds to see how profound this truth is about Jesus and to recognize what it should mean for us. So in the questions, and I'm going to get to the questions a lot sooner than I normally do, but it's the humanity of Jesus that John is talking about, of course, in his introduction there in those first few verses, and how that they were with him over a period of about 3 years, we know. And they were with him a good part of those 3 years, almost on a daily basis. And they saw his life. They saw his miracles. They heard his teachings. And except for Judas, they all died as those that believed in Jesus. Seems like all but the Apostle John died as martyrs because of their deep faith in Jesus being the Christ, the Son of God. And how remarkable that is. But the book of 1 John is kind of interesting insofar as of the subject of temptation and the subject of sin is concerned. Some of you have probably studied or you've had classes or you've heard Jared preach sermons where he may have mentioned teachers that were known as Gnostics. And they claim to have a superior knowledge, to know some things that others did not know. They appear to be very puffed up and very proud. But among the teaching of the Gnostics was one that had to do with Jesus coming and being a man. And how did they basically feel about that, about Jesus becoming flesh? What did they think? Ashley?
It's my understanding that you stated something here in your second question. They basically believed that human flesh was evil even. Unclean at the very least and arguably evil. And so how could you argue that the Son of God would stoop to that?
Yeah, precisely. That God, and so they created, and I don't think I could explain it, but they believed that it was more of a vision of Jesus or an image of Jesus, but it was not actually a physical. That's why some of these words used by John have such meaning. That it wasn't just like a dream in the night, or we think we saw something, but we're uncertain of it. No. He says, we touched with our hands. they knew these things. And of course, the accounts that we find in the Gospels bear out what John is saying here. They speak of Jesus as a man and his going about. We have just a little bit about his birth. We have a little incident when he was 12 years old. But basically, most of it picks up with him going to be baptized by John the Baptist and then the 3 years of his ministry. So I've asked the question here in number two, what does it seem that these false teachers were saying about what we have to understand or accept as being true in our lives? And I gave you a couple of passages. And in this first passage in John 1 and verse 6, if we say we have fellowship with him and yet walk in the darkness, we lie and do not practice the truth. Paul, does it seem like he is making a reference to what some of them may have been claiming or saying, or how do you understand this?
It seems to be based off the fact, if we take, you know, in Asia Minor, in Greece, in the areas in which the Gospels transitioned and towards the end of the first century, where they get Greek philosophy and they start to understand, you know, believe in and the use of that mm-hmm. you know, based off of this understanding that everything created is evil, then the only thing that you can do in this created world which is evil is only perpetuate that evilness.
Yeah, so we're pretty limited as men then. Because this is the way the universe is. This is the way our world is. And to think that, and so if there is going to be any kind of fellowship, and a lot of times we forget this. We forget about all of the mysticism, all the teaching of the Greek philosophers and such. We forget about that being what some of the Roman Empire was like, the places where the gospel was proclaimed. What was going on? You know, I was talking to somebody before class began tonight, and we were talking about some of the major universities and what you're likely to hear in some of those places and the mood. And there's some conceit and pride and some condescending attitudes that exist in those places. That these are the thinkers, the great thinkers. They're the educated ones. They're the ones that have really delved deeply into all of the different truths that are available. And they're the ones that we need to look at and decide about things. In our society today, I think that's a great divide that we see taking place, that we have these intellectuals that are talking to us about the way we ought to conduct ourselves, and most of us are just pretty simple people, aren't we? And our backgrounds are pretty simple. It doesn't matter how many classes you've taken, where you've taken them, but have they caused you to lose your common sense about certain things, or to deal rationally with certain challenges that all societies face? But anyway, the Gnostics basically wanted to say you could have fellowship with God even though you practice darkness. Because darkness is just going to be something you can't help. And the same idea is found in chapter 2. In fact, it's found in several places. But the one who says, I have come to know him and does not keep his commandments is a liar. The truth is not in him. And so they were wanting to give people a pass so far as their lives were concerned. And say, you can't help but sin. Do you think that there are religious people in our day that accept that kind of idea? I see some heads shaking. Yes. You want to expound on that? I mean, do you at all?
Yes. I think that there's a lot of the same seeds in Calvinism and in the ideas that are very popular among branches of Christianity. Evangelicals think that you just can't help but sin and God's grace takes care of everything.
Okay, yeah, yeah. We are the red-headed stepchild, so to speak, of Christianity. Do you know what that means? I used to have red hair when I had hair, and before it turned white, I used to have red hair. Delana had red hair too. We had three red-headed kids. Can you imagine why or how that happened? Why do you guys talk so much about obedience? Have you heard that? Don't you know that we're saved by grace? Don't you know that? Are we saved by grace? Absolutely, we're saved by grace. Are we saved by our works? We are not saved by our works. But that does not mean that this umbrella of grace falls upon everybody no matter how sincere your heart is or how hard you are trying to please God. And it is. There's a great conflict there. And it's hard to have a discussion about certain things, even a topic like baptism. But Calvinism is a good example of that very idea. Any other thoughts about this? Do you think we see it among members of the church at times? I kind of see a little sort of, yeah. Do we need to be forgiving of each other? Obviously. Who are the ones that deserve most of our patience? Or we know without question, they deserve our patience. They deserve our patience. Who are the ones that you would put in that category?
New Christians.
I'm glad somebody caught where I was going. Younger Christians, newer Christians, people that have just come out of the world, that this is all brand new to them. They've lived a life where they followed a different course. I've asked this question before, I'm not going to ask it again. Probably a lot of us are second generation Christians. Some of us may be third or fourth generation Christians. And there are certain things that even if we came out of a denomination, there are certain things that, I mean, we grew up, that's not right. Those are things that aren't right. But we have a lot of people, and in our day, you know, the idea of tolerance, it's an important topic. It's an important topic. And the idea of loving others, it's absolutely, that's God's truth. But if there are those that deserve most of our patience, what will we perhaps do a little bit differently with those that are older, that have been in the faith longer, and we see them in sin? How might our attitude change a little bit, or our approach to talking about them change a little bit?
Well, it would be the opposite.
Okay. Meaning, help me out.
Meaning that we probably are shorter with them because they know better.
Okay. Do you all agree with what Gary has said? Do you understand what he's saying? When people know better or should know better, that doesn't mean that you shouldn't be patient. You shouldn't be forgiving. You shouldn't be long-suffering. Doesn't mean that. But if we see those who are older, they may need to be dealt with in a slightly firmer way, if that makes sense.
One thing I think that we miss is each of us has a responsibility. It doesn't have to be a congregation going to talk to them or the elders going to talk to them. We should have a relationship open enough that we can go talk to anyone, no matter what age they are. If they're older, sometimes we are intimidated because, oh, they're older, you know, they're crotchety and can't talk to them. Well, guess what? We still should talk to them.
No, I'm glad you said that, Gary.
Yeah, exactly.
Don't talk to me about being older. And again, always with love, trying to speak the truth in love. Always, always. And especially if we see something that it's not the first time it's happened. It's happened and it's happened and, you know. You know, we may need to say, you know, hey, we don't have any Bobs in here, do we? Hey, Bob, let's have coffee. I need to talk to you. I need to tell you that there's some things that concern me. And I love you, and the only reason I'm saying these things is because I'm concerned about where you're at spiritually. Every discussion that we have about a spiritual matter ought to be because we are concerned with where they're at spiritually. We're not trying to reprimand somebody. We're not trying to act like I'm better than you are. I've got fewer flaws than you do. But because we have a legitimate spiritual concern. Anyway, I don't want to get too hung up on this, but I do think that there is that kind of, if we're not careful, that we sometimes feel that we can't tell it like it is, that we have to avoid the elephant in the room, that we have to avoid the problems that are happening. I'm going to get myself in trouble if I'm not careful. I noticed somebody the other day saying something to a couple of our young people, and I didn't catch the conversation. But I think they were just saying, you need to pay attention during worship. You need to be focused on worship. I assumed that that might have been what that little discussion was about. And sometimes we feel that, no, you don't touch those kind of topics. You don't mention anything like that. You don't say anything about that. And no, I was glad that that person, if that's what they were saying, I was glad that they were doing that. And I had enough of confidence in those young people that they would say, yeah, we'll do better. Yeah, sorry about that, we'll do better. And So anyway, let me jump down here, otherwise I'm going to get... So some of these passages, I asked the question in number 3, would you agree that there are some passages which would seem to suggest that mankind is born with an almost natural disposition towards evil? The passage I gave in Psalms 51:5, I don't know if that was a good one to use or not, but David says that he was conceived in iniquity, basically. Now, I kind of feel like I think that his language is hyperbole, and that he is saying, how can I approach you and ask you for mercy, Father? It just seems like I have allowed evil to take place in my life, and it's been there since the very conception. Now, not everybody would agree with that in what is understood there. But you go to a passage like Ephesians 2, and the word natural is used, or by nature is used, and it causes some to think that what's being said by the Apostle Paul there, let's read the passage, Ephesians 2, beginning in verse 1, you were dead in your trespasses and sins, in which you formerly walked according to the course of this world, according to the prince of the power of the air, of the spirit that is now working in the sons of disobedience. Among them we too all formerly lived in the lust of our flesh, indulging the desires of the flesh and of the mind, and were by nature children of wrath, even as the rest. And I've made the point before, I think even in this class, that it's my understanding that this refers to something that becomes an inborn part of who you are because of constant or continual repeating of that. That just as I think we use the example of an athlete that goes through certain drills over and over and over again, so that it becomes second nature to a certain movement does. And that's the idea, and it's not that this is our nature. But the Calvinists would say that is your nature. That is your nature. And that you're born in sin, and that you've inherited Adam's sin, and you've inherited this inclination to do wrong from the very beginning. And the passage over in Romans 3 and verse 10 is where Paul is pointing out the condemnation of all men. And most of the quotes that he has in that section, perhaps all of the quotes, are from the Psalms. And that there are none that are righteous, no, not one. There's none that do good. And you look at that, and this might support the idea that sin is something that can't be helped. But while you have these kind of passages, what do you do with all of the other passages that say you can control and that you should control? What do you do with all of those passages? I brought up the example of Romans 7 for a reason. I think that Romans 7 is written in a particular context. And that context is the inability of the law to justify man. That Paul is not talking about a Christian in his life, although a lot of the things might seem to apply. But he's basically talking about how that through a system of law that we're bound for failure. But he says in this text, beginning in chapter 7, I said verse 14. I'm going to back up just a little bit. Verse 7, what shall we say then? Is the law sin? A lot of the things that he's writing in the book of Romans are particularly for Jews to think about. But he says to them, what shall we say then? Is the law sin? May it never be. On the contrary, I would not have come to know sin except through the law. For I would not have known about coveting if the law had not said, you shall not covet. But sin, and he personifies sin, taking opportunity through the commandment, produced in me coveting of every kind. For apart from the law, sin is dead. Now, I want to again use the word hyperbole. That here is an example of exaggeration to make a point. Somebody that doesn't read this with the correct understanding of figurative language, as well as the text, the context being a discussion of the law, may think we are just as weak as a tiny kitty cat and we have no power at all to determine our course and our behavior. That to have a character, a set character, to be faithful to God is just throw it out the window. It just isn't going to happen. It cannot happen. And I do not believe for one moment that that's what Paul says. Paul says this is the case if we live in the flesh, which is what the law caused people to basically do on many fronts. Yes, Alex?
Yeah, just to your point, I mean, Paul considers himself, what, the worst of all sinners, right? So for this guy to write all these letters, would you not think that this would not hold weight if he was not able to, you know, pass his quote-unquote nature, as we were discussing, to be more, you know? Like, there's weight to his work. That's why these letters are in the Bible, because there is weight there. You know, Hebrews, you know, to be better. Thessalonians, excel still more. That's like, yeah, I mean, let's get some motivation here more than, well, let's throw up our hands and give up since we're nothing.
Yeah. And Paul, it not only was that he persecuted the Christians and that he denied Christ, but no doubt that he was bound up in such pride that he couldn't consider the other side about Jesus. And the Pharisees, of course, in their pride. But good point, Alex. But he goes on then, and he says about sin, verse 9. I was once alive apart from the law, but when the commandment came, sin came alive, and I died. And this commandment, which was to result in life, it proved to result in death for me. For sin, taking an opportunity through the commandment, deceived me, and through it killed me. So then the law is holy, and the commandment is holy, and righteous, and good. Remember that the old law, that there was not really a complete satisfaction and complete forgiveness of sins. It was impossible for the blood of bulls and goats to really blot out our transgressions. So how many sins did it take for one to stand under condemnation? Just one. And he says, so the commandment, it's holy and it's righteous, it's good. But he says in verse 13, therefore did that which is good become a cause of death for me? May it never be. He said, I'm not blaming the law. Rather, it was sin, in order that it might be shown to be sin by affecting my death through that which is good, so that through the commandment sin would become utterly sinful. And he goes on with this thought. And some of this, you know, we probably can identify with, because we've had those weak moments. He says in verse 15, for what I am doing, I do not understand. For I'm not practicing what I would like to do, but I'm doing the very thing that I hate. Now, the more mature that we come, those moments ought to be a lot briefer, a lot shorter. And we come to our senses pretty quick, if we've got any kind of conscience at all. And we say to ourselves, what in the world am I doing going down this road? Why am I allowing myself to become angry to this extent? Why am I allowing that to happen? I know that's wrong. I know that's wrong. Why am I allowing it? I had contact with a buyer this week wanting to buy a home. And there were 14 offers made on the house. It's a beautiful house. Beautiful house. And their offer was regarded as number 9 in which offer to take. These people are supposed to be Christians. They're not members of this group. But I found out a couple days later, I was trying to say, hey, here's a nice looking house, and here's a good looking house. And I found out that the wife was still heartbroken over losing that house. And I thought, how does a Christian allow themselves to let that happen. That you see something, and it made me think about Ahab and Naboth's vineyard. And him going into his room, and didn't he turn his face to the wall, sort of, in that situation? And he was sitting there brooding and not able to think about, you know, anything but his disappointment. And so if we get to thinking and we're plotting and we're thinking, okay, how can I afford that? And what can I, and what, maybe I could do this and maybe I could do that. And we get to the point where that, you know, as a Christian, we say, wait, this is stupid. This is silly. That I'm letting a desire for a physical thing become so strong that I might make decisions that aren't very wise. And I told them all along, I said, don't make dumb decisions that are going to hurt you. Don't do that. And so a Christian, if when it talks here about, I do not understand what I'm doing. What do you mean you don't understand what you're doing? How can this be said to somebody that's under God's grace through Jesus? How can somebody say, I don't understand what I'm doing because I'm not practicing what I would like to do? What's wrong with you that you can't exert more discipline than that? Paul in the Corinthian letter said that he did what on a daily basis? Buffeted his body? And he said, even after I've preached to others, I myself, you know, could become rejected. So anyway, the whole point of this is that the context of this is referring to being under a system of law. And he says in verse 24, wretched man that I am, who will set me free from the body of this death? And then he gives the answer in verse 25. Thanks be to God through Jesus Christ our Lord. So then on the one hand, I myself with my mind am serving the law of God, but on the other with my flesh, the law of sin. We do have to fight against fleshly appetites. It is a part of the battle that we have that goes on. But in verse or in chapter 8, he's going to go on and talk about living according to the Spirit and not the flesh. But we're under a system of grace through our faith and forgiveness. And it's not every little moment of that's going to condemn us for all eternity that is being discussed there. So anyway, going to save most of this for when we come back after the meeting, but I want you to read these passages in the book of Hebrews. I want you to think about what does Jesus being able to resist temptation? He lived as a man. He lived in a physical body. He had appetites. He was tempted in all points like as we are. What does that mean for us? Is there a benefit for us in knowing that? And was that necessary? Was there a, other than wanting to exalt God and to recognize that we should be trying to please God and honor God? So I want you to look at that, and then I want you to look at the temptations that Jesus had in the wilderness. Why did Jesus fast so long before he went out there, or as he was out there? Was this planned beforehand? Had he planned it's going to be 40 days and 40 nights? Or was the matters that he was praying about and fasting about, did they just seem to be so critical and crucial, and that he remained in that state of mind and fasting? But Satan comes to him when he's terribly weak physically. You would think people are capable of a lot more than they sometimes know with some of this stuff. But anyway, I want you to identify where in Scripture did these quotations come from. He quotes three passages, and they aren't very far from one another in the Old Testament. And I want you to then look at the context of where those quotes are from. And I want you to say to yourself, what was Jesus thinking about that he would use these passages? What was on his mind? What was he trying to get deeply entrenched in his thinking when he came and was tempted by Satan? Okay. You can go ahead and bring that. Who's got the closing prayer tonight? You do, Bernard? Okay. Anything else that needs to be said before we're dismissed? Bernard, would you come and lead us? Or you can from there if you can say it loudly. It's up to you.